It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. If you're of a certain age and you try to keep your brain sharp with certain mental exercises, one particular type of mental exercise may succeed at doing what nothing else has done before, putting off dementia. A new 10-year study showed that speed training, computer exercises that get users to visually process information more quickly, speed training, beat out memory and reasoning exercises, which are two other popular brain training techniques. Researchers found that a total of 11 to 14 hours of speed training has the potential to cut by as much as 48% the risk of developing dementia 10 years later. The study was called Active for Advanced Cognitive Training in Vital Elderly, and the results were presented Sunday in Toronto at an Alzheimer's Association International Conference. I am cribbing this from Sumathi Reddy's story in today's Wall Street Journal, headlined, A Speed Training Brain Exercise Puts Off Dementia. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR. As the city of Flint continues its slow recovery from its lead-tainted water crisis, a new project aims at improving nutrition in the city. As in many urban cores across the country, there are pockets of Flint that may be classified as food deserts, places where socioeconomic factors make it difficult for people to access fresh food. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now with more on an effort to resolve some of those issues. Kevin, you spent a little time in Flint yesterday.
Yes, I did, Mark. The project is called Flint Fresh. It's a collaboration involving many local farmers, community gardeners, and some nonprofit groups. There is also some research coming out of Michigan State University, the College of Human Medicine, that is helping to guide their work. And the goal is to create a much more sustainable food system in neighborhoods where residents have little or no grocery options.
The international spotlight that's fallen on the city of Flint in the wake of its water crisis has focused attention on problems many residents say should have been dealt with decades ago. Long before the lead contamination scandal went public, Flint residents struggled with a challenge just as fundamental as water: finding fresh food. Over the years, as businesses bailed and population plummeted, Flint found itself with few grocery options. Most big retail chains built in the suburbs, leaving a handful of mom-and-pop stores to pick up the slack. Today, the retail food industry in Flint remains a patchwork.
Our food system in Flint is broken.
Pam Bailey is the public relations director for a new initiative getting underway in the city called Flint Fresh.
We're hearing the community say that right now it is not adequate. And so what Flint Fresh is doing is trying to jumpstart that, trying to be the catalyst to recreate that. We firmly believe that we want to work ourselves out of a job, that we can inspire and help and cultivate food growers and food systems and retailers and be that supportive piece until that food system can be thriving again in Flint.
Well, how broken is broken? Obviously, people do eat, but probably not to the level that we would like them.
Broken is it's a difficult word. We do have stores. We have independent grocery stores. We have small grocery stores. But we still hear from a lot of people that access to fresh fruits and vegetables, quality meats, quality cheeses, dairies, animal products is difficult. There are definitely gaps in the city. There are some wonderful retailers who do sell quality products, but there are definitely gaps in areas in the city where it is difficult to reach that, and especially people who are on the poverty level, people who have transportation issues, people who have ability issues. It makes it very difficult to find a grocery store to provide that. So those are the people we're trying to reach, the people who don't have the adequate transportation, accessibility, and even affordability to get those wonderful products.
Limited access to fresh food means consumers are left to purchase canned, boxed, and otherwise processed foods, high-sodium items which health experts say don't offer the same nutritional benefits as fresh or frozen.
So you've just pretty much said the reason why I became a farmer?
Aaron Caudell is co-owner of The Local Grocer, a small food retailer near downtown Flint. She's also an operating partner in the Flint Fresh project. Caudell says there are not enough local producers out there growing the products people need.
We don't have enough small farmers. We have an aging farmer population, and we have areas like Flint that get their food from far away, that it has a lot of chemicals in it, and this is really trying to come up with an alternative way to give people some healthy options of food that's grown locally without chemicals. So trying to reduce that chemical level that people have and trying to give people some fresh alternatives.
Along Flint's Martin Luther King Avenue, Jane Richardson helps oversee a building painting project. Richardson is a special projects facilitator with the nonprofit Neighborhood Engagement Hub. She sees the food crisis firsthand. The nearby store in this section of town is called Hinky Dinky. Richardson says logistical challenges limit the store's selection.
If you needed produce, you would not be able to get anything. In the past, you would not be able to get anything that spoiled quickly. So you couldn't get greens, you couldn't get lettuce, you could get beets, you could get potatoes, you could get oranges, you couldn't get bananas, you know. Anything that spoiled quickly did not move fast enough for that store to be able to afford it, and I hope that will change.
That change could happen soon. Hinky Dinky is under new management as of this week. Richardson has just met the new owner. Across the street, another service project is underway. About 15 people are clearing branches from a vacant lot, including Barbara Culp. She concedes her own shopping situation could be a lot worse.
What is it like grocery shopping in Flint? Is it adequate? Do you have to travel a long distance?
I do. But, you know, actually I can say it's okay for me because I got transportation and I can go and I know how to do it online now, you know. But the people that don't have those capabilities, it's not good. Right now I've been going to Fresh Choice, the store that just opened up over on the east side. That's closer than anything. Even Aldi's, that's one of my favorite shops. But anyway, yeah.
Can I ask how you're handling things with the water situation day to day?
Well, we have places we can go and get water, and I'm doing that. We're still bathing in the water, so it's, you know. But we're still having to pay for it, too. So it's you know, it's been strange. It's, you know, just actually, you just got to do what you got to do. And I think that's what the people of Flint has done. You know, you just don't stop just because you got lead in your water. You got to continue from here, you know. And so hopefully that won't happen again. Hopefully they'll come up with the right things to do.
The Flint Fresh team is relying on geospatial models that indicate where in the city the lack of fresh food is most acute. That's the work of Dr. Rick Sadler. He's an assistant professor in the Division of Public Health with the Michigan State University College of Human Medicine in Flint. Sadler took his study to the streets, asking community leaders and everyday citizens about the factors that inhibit their ability to access fresh food. Then Sadler assigned a weight or value to those variables. It was a carefully constructed ground game.
And so what I wound up with was an expert-derived weight assignment for these variables. And so what was most important wound up being the access to healthy foods and socioeconomic distress. So those combined account for over half of the weighting in the map.
So that means then, in layman's terms, in a more impoverished neighborhood, you may have perhaps a 1 to 5 scale, and 5 would be a greater weight, meaning the need is more acute there.
Yeah, for sure. So with an unweighted scale, you wouldn't give preference to those lower income, poor food access neighborhoods. But the way that this weighting was derived, those areas get a lot of the weighting.
Why is this important to you personally?
This is important to me for a number of reasons. I grew up in the Flint area. My parents grew up in the Flint area, so this is home. And most of the work I do is oriented around the Flint community. From the time I was a kid, it bothered me. From the time I could start seeing that there were injustices, spatial, racial, socioeconomic, in our community, it bothered me, and I wanted to do something about it. And healthy eating is important to me as a geographer and a researcher and a human being, because it's so obvious that there are spatial inequities in access to healthy foods. And access to healthy foods is such a basic, fundamental element of health. And, if you can't eat healthy, you're going to have all these other health issues down the road. But if you can start at the base level and eat healthy, get physical activity, have a community that promotes those types of activities, then the whole society will be healthier and happier.
The reintroduction of fresh produce in Flint took a big step forward 2 years ago when the Flint Farmers Market located to its present site downtown. Now Flint Fresh will take that access to the next level. At the heart of the project is a mobile market, that is, a food truck, that will deliver products to specific neighborhoods. Farmer Aaron Caudell foresees both social and economic benefits ahead.
What makes Flint Fresh and the idea of our mobile market a little bit different and unique to this community is that we have a lot of community gardeners, and this gives community gardeners a way to sell some of their extra produce and make a little income generation on the side. So for us, we really see this as it's both a business development, it's a jobs incubator, it's a way of adding a little bit of side income to some of our gardeners here in Flint, and that really gives us a chance to recycle those dollars here in our own community.
And there's one last point Flint Fresh wants its future patrons to hear. PR Director Pam Bailey says fresh, non-processed food is the only way to mitigate the effects of elevated blood lead levels.
Do you think that the ongoing water crisis, which has gained international attention, has been a catalyst that has put Flint Fresh in the spotlight? Is this perhaps a positive result of what's otherwise a negative situation?
If I can take anything positive out of this situation that our residents are going through, that yes, this has been a catalyst. It is finally getting people to look and to help at a problem that Flint has been suffering for a long time. So if we can pull anything positive from this awful situation, is that people are finally coming and helping us and finally bringing funding and expertise and all these resources that we've been lacking to be able to do this. And hopefully we can make change so that for our future generations, for our children, they don't suffer from these problems anymore. They don't suffer from these systematic issues that have plagued Flint.
Flint Fresh is planning its formal launch in the city next month. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, a former oil company executive is awaiting confirmation to become the state's next director of the Department of Environmental Quality. And an assessment of Enbridge Energy's controversial Line 5 at the Mackinac Straits is in the works. Great Lakes environmental reporter Gary Wilson joins me to discuss those on Current State's Environment Month in Review, coming up. Most people's roots are determined by family. At Current State's last pop-up stories gathering, one pair of storytellers explained how their roots were also determined by their work. Here are Paul Schmidt-Gall and his Lansing partner Nick Nuvo, recorded live at the Allen Marketplace in Lansing.
I'm originally from Peoria, Illinois. Live in Naples, Florida now, and just kind of up here in Lansing to, you know, kind of spread our business and put some local roots down. My story, basically, when I started out, kind of a rootless wonder, I came from a broken home, wasn't a great student, so I decided going to the military was the thing to do. I joined the military right out of high school. Next thing you know, they're like, where do you want to go? I'm like, I want to go back to Illinois. I want to be there by my family. They're like, great, you're going to Germany. And I'm like, well, that works out, doesn't it? So spent 2 years in Germany, did a bunch of work in Spain. That's kind of how I came about the business that I've got. And from there, I was getting ready to leave Germany, and they said, you know what? We're going to send you to Utah via Saudi Arabia. So I got deployed for the first Gulf War, just got popped around like every 6 months, and then 2 years, I was in southern Utah. I just had no place that was mine. So finally, I actually went to go work as a cook, a chef, whatever, to Johnson & Wales, worked at a bunch of restaurants, had my own, and then a gentleman came in, hired me, and I worked for his family for 8 years. That's how I got to Naples, Florida. And I actually felt like I had something, like I had a family, like I had a place. And it was such a great feeling that I never experienced. I was 30 years old, you know, and it was just something that I wanted for everybody. And then one day he kind of pulled me aside and he said, you know, if you ever want anything in life, he's like, you can work for everybody and it's great. But if you want anything, you got to grab it and you got to take it. So he's like, you need to start your own business. And I'm like, I don't want to start my own business. He's like, well, you're not going to have a job here. So you got 60 days to figure it out. Okay. Nothing like stress to, you know, kind of throw you into it. So I did. I started this catering company. I do paella. It's what I specialize in. I don't go into other avenues. I just do what I do. I do one thing, and I try to do it really well. But what happened was it became really successful in Naples. And then I found Naples was my home. It was a place that I could call my own. And it's still mine. I mean, it's on my shirts. It's everywhere. I love Naples. Even when it's 100 in the summer, it's my home. But what I want is I wanted to create something where people could do the same thing in different locations. So I decided to franchise my business, and it's been a tough couple, 3-4 years, but we got it done. And actually, Nick and Jim, another guy here from Lansing, bought one of my franchises. So I said, instead of you coming to me, why don't I have a great idea and come to you? Never been to Lansing, never been to Michigan. So, like, why not? So I hopped in the truck with the trailer and all their equipment, and I drove 28 hours to get here. Got here, have done some events. We got into the Allen Place Market here, another home. You know, this is where we are. This is where we put our roots down. And this is their home now. But what I like about it is we're giving them an opportunity to change their own lives. They're going to be business owners. They're from this community. They can grow. They can be. And hopefully employ other people and change other people's lives. So that's what we want to try to do. Not only have we done that here, which is awesome, but we've done it in Fort Myers. We've done it in Memphis. I'm getting ready to go after I leave here. We're going to go do it in Connecticut. So with that, I'll let Nick have 60 seconds to talk.
There we go. I like that. Well, my story starts here. My roots are here. I was born and raised in the Lansing area. Both my parents were born and raised in the Lansing area. When I went to college, I actually got to get away from Lansing for a little bit for 4 years and moved up to Mount Pleasant. I lived in town, and then I wanted to live in a bigger city. So I kept wanting to move my roots, but something always pulled me back here to Lansing. I remember actually sitting at one of my buddy's house watching Tom Izzo talk about his speech that he's not going to leave Lansing. He's not going to leave East Lansing. He's here. And I started to get tears in my eyes, and I'm like, that was my calling. It's time for me to stay here. I met my beautiful fiance working in the restaurant industry. She's from the area. We've been together for 7.5 years. We have 2 kids. Some of our kids were born here. So these are our roots. So we knew that this is going to be the place that we're going to live for the rest of our lives. I ultimately wanted to own my own business and got to meet Paul, and here we are today. So our roots are planted even more in here because this is where our business started. This is where my family grew up. And I'm going to be here forever. Lansing's my home, and my roots are here. And that's my story.
Nick Nuvo and Paul Schmidtgall there, recorded live at our last Current State Pop-Up Stories event. Our next gathering is this Thursday night. We're calling it The Call of the Wild. You can hear true first-person live stories about nature and wildlife and the outdoors beginning at 7 p.m. at Valley Court Park in East Lansing. Keep in mind, this will precede the showing of Where the Wild Things Are. This is part of the City of East Lansing's Moonlight Film Festival. The movie starts at 9:30. Our storytelling starts at 7 p.m. and runs until about 8:30. We ask that if you're also attending the movie, please bring your own chairs because we got to take our chairs with us after we're done with storytelling. Okay? So we appreciate that. Please join us if you can. More information on our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. That's Thursday night, Valley Court Park, East L.A. Coming up on Current State, the Washtenaw Community Concert Band goes to Tinseltown for its next performance this week. We'll speak with Dr. Chris Heidenreich about these Hollywood blockbusters and learn about some of the costume changes he's had to make in Ann Arbor. That and more after the break on Current State. Current State, three times every weekday here on WKAR. You can catch us live between 9 and 10 a.m. And again, between 6 and 7 p.m. on 90.5 FM. Our program airs on AM 870 every day at 12 o'clock noon. And it's always available online at WKAR.org. We're glad you can join us on whatever platform. July has included several important environmental news stories here in Michigan. Governor Rick Snyder's administration has tapped Heidi Grether, a former oil company lobbyist, to become the next head of the state's Department of Environmental Quality. A plan has taken shape to assess risks associated with Enbridge Energy's Line 5, and a lingering chapter in the Kalamazoo River oil spill was closed when Enbridge agreed to more than $100 million in fines. Here to review those developments in our monthly look back at environmental news, Chicago-based Great Lakes journalist and commentator Gary Wilson. Welcome back, Gary.
Good morning, Mark. Good to be back with you, as always.
The Snyder administration announced its choice to head Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality a couple of weeks ago. Who is Heidi Grether?
Well, Mark, sure. Grether has been working for the Michigan Agency for Energy, and don't worry, I never heard of that agency either. And she's been there for the past year, but she's better known for her work at BP, as you mentioned. That's British Petroleum. And yes, it's that BP. There, she served as a lobbyist and was the public persona for BP's handling of the Gulf of Mexico oil rig blowout a couple of years ago. I think we all remember that. And on her LinkedIn page, she lists as an accomplishment that her work resulted in, and I'm quoting here, no negative actions against BP, so listeners can think whatever they will about that. I'm told by a colleague who knows her that she's a person of decency, but her tendency is to align with business interests, so I guess that bears some watching. That's what I know to the best of my ability here. She hasn't engaged the media yet, so we'll have to see.
In the Snyder administration's eyes, Gary, what makes her a good choice for DEQ then?
Well, the governor's office has been touting skills that she has that may be able to change the culture at the MDEQ. These are presumably soft skills like instilling compassion in an agency that needs some, improving communication. Those were criticisms leveled at the MDEQ by Governor Snyder's Flint task force. They said that the MDEQ was full of technocrats who forgot, you know, that there are people at the other end of the pipe. So my guess is that's going to be her primary goal.
Given her background in the oil industry, is the environmental community responding as we might expect?
Yeah, I think so. Well, first they had to get over the shock of seeing BP and new MDEQ head in the same sentence.
Right.
One environmentalist said he thought he was reading a headline from the satirical magazine The Onion when he saw the announcement. But with time, at least the Michigan Environmental Council has become more circumspect. Andy McGlashan, the media guy there, told me yesterday that they'll be focused on what she does going forward versus what she did at BP. They'd like to see, McGlashan said, a less business-friendly approach and one that's focused on protecting health and the environment. So they'll be watching.
And you've been watching this landscape for a while. Gary Wilson, what do you make of the choice?
Well, Mark, it's not one that I would have made if for no other reason that the optics are horrible on it. BP exec is going to be, you know, sort of in charge of Flint to simplify it. But she deserves a chance. It's just that she's starting in negative territory, and she doesn't have room for a hiccup. You know, post-Flint, the whole world is watching the MDEQ. Snyder could have done better, but I hope I'm wrong. But her task is going to be difficult, carrying all that BP baggage around, though.
The week before last, the organization Common Cause Michigan asked the Snyder administration to release all communications leading up to Ms. Grether's recommendation. What do you make of that request?
Oh, Mark, I don't know. Honestly, it appears to be a bit of a fishing expedition. They're maybe playing on the weakness of the Snyder administration after the Flint debacle. if I were a watchdog group, I'd focus my attention on what she does. Will she really change the culture at the MDEQ versus just, you know, window dressing? You know, at the end of the day, at the end of her tenure, will people in Flint and Detroit and elsewhere be better off? That should be the marker.
Gary Wilson is Current State's Great Lakes environmental reporter. This is our monthly review of environmental news here in Michigan. We have several developments to discuss involving Enbridge Energy. First of all, 2 weeks ago today, we learned of two companies that will study Enbridge's Line 5 running under and near the Mackinac Straits. There are two parts to this, I understand. What are those?
Well, Mark, first there's the risk assessment, a Canadian company, and bear with me here, Dynamic Risk Assessment Systems. They're going to evaluate the current pipeline and its alternatives, presumably to its ability to continue to function safely. A second company with a name that's no easier to pronounce here, it's a DET, D-E-T, like the abbreviation for Detroit, DET Norsk Veritas, and they're going to do a financial risk assessment looking at the cost of the worst-case scenario.
Enbridge is offering to pay for the studies. How is that going over? What's been the response to that?
Well, it's a big selling point for Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette, who's touting the fact widely that this won't cost the taxpayers any money, and Enbridge is the bad guy here, and having them pay plays well to the public. But there's concern, again, from environmental groups, because Enbridge, as it turns out, is going to get to see the report 5 days before it goes public. Now, I contacted Andrea Bitely from Bill Schuette's office, the Attorney General's office, and she told me that Enbridge will not be able to make any suggestions or edits to the report. They're getting the preview only to allow them time to formulate a response. And Bitely reiterated with a lot of enthusiasm of Attorney General Schuette's earlier position, and I'm quoting here, that the pipeline's days are numbered. Mm. Now, that begs the question, if they're numbered, why all the assessment? But I guess it's something they have to go through.
Would the public be better served by studies if they were paid for by the state?
Well, I think they would, definitely, yes. I understand the Attorney General's desire to save taxpayers a few bucks, but there's a lot at stake here in the Straits of Mackinac. If I were the Attorney General, I'd avoid even a remote appearance that the risk assessment may be compromised by money.
Is it known when the studies will be conducted and when the results will be made public?
Well, the studies will start soon, and I think the results are due to be released sometime next year. These things always take a lot of time.
Last week, we learned that Enbridge will pay $177 million as a result of the 2010 Kalamazoo River oil spill. Can you put this into context for us? Is this a reasonable penalty given the damage, or is it a slap on the wrist, or is it too severe, or what?
No, I suppose it's reasonable, Mark. It's so hard to quantify these things. Some people wanted more, calling it the proverbial slap on the wrist. But the alternative is that has to be compared to taking years to fight it out in court. And if you go to court, you don't know what the outcome will be. You know, I suspect holding your nose and accepting the money, not the perfect result, is the best one. It's just that it perpetuates the model that spills are a cost of doing business and should be accepted as inevitable. Keeps the emphasis on the fact that remediation, is better than, the remediation versus, prevention conundrum.
This was a consent decree that was hammered out. Who exactly hammered it out?
Well, it was the U.S. Department of Justice working with the U.S. EPA. And after the announcement, I can tell you the EPA has been really selling this settlement. Acting regional administrator from Chicago, Robert Kaplan, has been saying that the Kalamazoo River's habitat, and I'm quoting again here, has absolutely been restored and there are no remnants of oil. So that's a big claim. Not sure everybody's on board with that, but that's his position.
Enbridge has also launched a PR campaign to enhance its image with the public. How are they going about this?
Well, I saw it on Twitter. My Twitter feed popped this Enbridge video featuring locals, you know, talking about the quality of the river. It's always best to have locals make that type of pitch than an oil company executive, you know, standing there preaching to the public. So I don't know how it's going, but they're making an effort to communicate. Now, whether people buy it or not is another question.
We've got a little bit of audio from one of those promotional videos. Let's listen to that now.
I'm Mike Olson. I'm the public safety director for Emmett Township. I've been here almost 40 years now, so the river's always been a part of us. Seeing a lot more people out there and a lot of people with some really positive comments about how much they enjoy their time and the changes that have been made. After you have a catastrophe such as we did when the oil spilled into the river, there's always going to be critics out there. You're not going to ever dispel that totally. If you look at the condition of the river, it certainly seems to meet all of my expectations.
There you go. Has there been much response or comment to these videos, Gary?
No, I think people are digesting them. That was pretty slick, by the way. Pardon the bad pun. You know, I think people take them with a grain of salt. If I'm not criticizing Enbridge, they're a business. They're trying to sell their accomplishments and demonstrate that they're good corporate citizens. And you know, that's a tall mountain for them to climb, but they're making an effort. So over the long term, we'll see how it plays out. They have to deliver now that they're touting their skills.
Gary Wilson is current state's Great Lakes environmental reporter. Once a month, we look back at the month's biggest environmental news. Gary Wilson, thank you.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR is a professor of music at the University of Michigan, Flint. Dr. Christopher Heidenreich is quite a busy guy. But as he told Current State's Jamie Paisley, he also frequently finds himself driving down to Ann Arbor, where he joins yet another group of students.
In my free time, I work with the Washtenaw Community Concert Band, which is an all-volunteer group. We perform at Washtenaw Community College, and we rehearse out of Whitmer Lake High School once a week, almost the entire year, September through July. We're wrapping up with our concert here in July.
Yeah. So I know that a lot of the members of the Washtenaw Community Concert Band, they're members of the community, but because it's year-round, do you lose some of the college students during this summertime?
Well, actually, we don't have very many college students throughout the regular year. We lose our members because, like all Michiganders, they go north. So right now we see fewer and fewer players as we get farther along in the summer, but we have a core group that if I had rehearsal three times a week, they'd be there every night. And I think to me, the Washtenaw Community Concert Band is the epitome of a community group. We have a judge. He is the circuit court judge for Washtenaw County. We have several other lawyers. We have homemakers. We have some English professors, some teachers in public school. We have one music teacher, actually two this time around. We've added a music teacher. She teaches somewhere in the Ann Arbor area, but I'm not sure. But I think the word amateur, meaning to love, is a perfect analogy for the group that we have. One of the things that I'm getting used to is our members are older. I call them seasoned. And we lost a member last fall, and we all found out that he was a physicist, a professor emeritus. He'd written a textbook, was an authority in his field. And we kind of scratched our heads and said, you know what? We have those members. We need to find out a little bit more. So we've been making an effort to find out more about our members.
Now, the concert that's coming up, the Hollywood Blockbusters concert, is the third and final of the free concerts, the free summer series that you've got with the Washington Community Concert Band, right?
The concert band was founded, this is our 37th year, so the end of our 37th season, on always giving free concerts. We do ask for donations. We have a great donor list, and we have members that go out and solicit donors in the community. The Yankee Air Museum is our series sponsor. Sometimes our own members find a way to sponsor a concert, and I believe one of our members is sponsoring this one, but I can't remember who. And then we ask our audience at some point during the concert if they would like to give a donation. They have an opportunity to do that, but all of our concerts are free. We even gave a concert this May in the Michigan Theater, and we were able able to secure a grant, and through the generous donation of a couple concert sponsorships, including the Yankee Air Museum, we again put on a free program.
And I think that one was the Sousa concert?
It was.
Which I have to ask then. Okay. I know that you dressed up as Sousa for this concert. Do you plan on dressing up as anybody for this one?
Not for this one. We had actually hired a guest, and the guest became ill. And about a month before the program, we decided, okay, it's time to go a different direction. And the different direction was, since I'm the conductor, I'd stay as the group conductor and we would find another trumpet solist because I was going to take that role. So as a part of it, I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I might as well do it all the way. So the costume shop at UM Flint helped suit me up. And I found out on Sunday, Sousa was very famous for wearing a white naval-like outfit. He started with the Marines, but in World War I, joined the Navy for $1 a year and organized the Navy band. So I went with the white outfit with a white hat and even found a little facial hair, which for me, I'm not going to grow that very quickly. So I had a little help from the makeup folks.
We're speaking with Dr. Christopher Heidenreich, who's been leading the Washtenaw Community Concert Band for 5 years. He'll conduct this Thursday night's Hollywood Blockbusters concert at the Towsley Auditorium on the Washtenaw Community College campus. And Chris, when it comes to repertoire in Hollywood, you got, 100 years or so of material to choose from, and, a little further back with classical-type pieces as well. How do you then go about choosing pieces when thinking about the playing ability of this amateur group?
And that's a real key, is the variety of playing levels. We have folks that have been playing and seasoned for 60-some years, maybe even a little bit longer. We're celebrating a couple birthdays this week that are kind of significant in the lives of these members. And then we have players that haven't been playing as long, but still might even have more ability than some of the players that have been playing longer. So it's always a challenge finding repertoire. I think in my 5 years, the thing that has changed the most is not just thinking about what the players can do, but also considering the audience. And that's kind of how the summer concert series go. I'm trying to keep it as upbeat and as interesting for our audience as I can. So last year we did a musical themed concert. Our first concert this year was entitled Something for Everybody. We actually had a piece based on a rap number, and we did an overture from Von Suppe, Poet and Peasant, and we were going to feature a soloist. The soloist couldn't make it, so it was just a wide variety. So the film program that we're going to do was just the result of, okay, how can we get our audience to buy in a little bit better?
Do you have any hints that you can give us about what this program might entail?
Sure. We're going to do a number that's traditional Hollywood. It's got Warren Barker is the arranger. It's got Hooray for Hollywood. That's actually the title of the piece. And there's some older tunes in there. Something's Coming Up Roses and Gone with the Wind is in there. So you've got some older themes that are in there. We're doing a Star Wars medley, kind of a precursor to our Halloween concert this year, which is called Space, the Final Frontier. And we'll do some more Star Wars music, some music from Star Trek. So I'm kind of laying some groundwork for what we're going to be doing this year. Another one of our tunes, we're doing the Pink Panther. And it's interesting to me, I've had some fun looking up some of those old Pink Panther movie clips with Peter Sellers. And it's interesting how many of some of the members didn't watch those movies. And when I was a kid, for some reason, they were just the greatest thing. We're doing a little music from Captain America, James Bond, Danny Elfman, a medley of four tunes from Danny Elfman.
Since we're also in the summer, you also have a scholarship that you give for the Blue Lake Summer Arts Festival as well. And I think it went to a middle or high schooler it has to go to. And this year was a percussionist that you sent off.
Adam was his name, and he's a young seventh grader. He is off to Blue Lake this session, as a matter of fact. And this award has been given by the community band for a number of years. We've had a history. I've only been a small part of that history. The group started as a group of people that wanted to get together, perform music, and they were associated with the Ypsilanti High School and the Ypsilanti Music Program. It's evolved, it's changed as things have changed, as life changes. But one of the former directors put down some funds to create an endowed scholarship. And the Blue Lake folks administer that scholarship for us. So we have no, all we do for it is provide the endowment and up it each year or contribute to it. We do not select the winner. The person has to nominate themselves by being from the area. So the name is essentially given to us by the Blue Lake folks. And Adam's been just a great addition. He was so excited. We actually had him perform on the last concert in the percussion section, and he had a great time. And we're really excited that we were a part of his start with Blue Lake.
Yeah. We've been speaking with Dr. Chris Heidenreich, conductor of the Washtenaw Community Concert Band and associate professor with tenure at the University of Michigan in Flint, about the Hollywood Blockbusters Concert and everything else that the Washtenaw Community Concert Band does. The Hollywood Blockbusters Concert comes up this Thursday, July 27th, 7:30 p.m. at the Towsley Auditorium on Washtenaw Community College. Mm-hmm. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for the time. Great to talk with you today.
You can find more information at wccband.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Payson.
WKAR in Current State. There is no shortage of festivals and concerts around Lansing in the summer, and this weekend brings one of the tastiest. The Taste of Downtown returns for its seventh year to downtown Lansing this Saturday. Here to tell us more, Executive Director of Downtown Lansing, Inc., Mindy Bilodeau. Hi, Mindy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, certainly, our pleasure. And owner of American Fifth Spirits on North Larch, Rick Weibel. Hi, Rick.
Good morning.
Mindy, tell us, peel off the names of a few restaurants that will be participating this year.
There are over a dozen. We have Tavern on the Square, Lansing Brewing Company, Glazed and Confused, Juice Nation, For Crepe's Sake, Whipped Bakery, The Beer Grotto, and so much more.
Are new participants this year?
Yeah, Whipped Bakery and Glazed and Confused are definitely two new ones, two bakeries that do different things.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
It is.
Rick, it's midsummer. Which cocktails do you think customers will be ordering the most?
Well, ginger seems to be very popular still, so we're going to provide our Michigan Mule, which is our locally made vodka with Verner's. So that's always
now,
a popular one.
Not a Moscow Mule, a Michigan Mule.
Correct.
Love it. Love it. How many different cocktails will you be prepared to make at the event?
We're going to offer two different cocktails,
okay.
The Michigan Mule and then one with a little bit of spice to it, a little spice and pineapple.
I got to ask, though, how many can your people make? How many different cocktails can you make?
Well, on site for the festival, we only prepare two.
No, I'm just talking about in general. If you had every liquor that you possibly want, how many could you prepare?
Oh, geez, we continually serve around 40 in our tasting room in downtown.
This will be your second year at the event. What did participation in this event last year do for you? It must have increased your profile somewhat.
It did. Being out in front of people always helps bring awareness, not only for us, but obviously for the rest of the vendors too. And then it also develops a sense of community. Showing what downtown Lansing is and is turning into is always a nice feature.
Mindy, where will you be set up?
We will be on the 100 block of South Washington Square, so right between Michigan Avenue at the traffic circle and Allegan Street.
There's also some live music from some local bands. Who will be performing?
We have Taylor, Phil Denny, Avon Baum, and Air Margaritaville, which is a Jimmy Buffett cover band from the Detroit area.
All right. Sounds like a good time for a July weekend. I'm talking with Mindy Bilodeau, Executive Director of Downtown Lansing Incorporated, and American Fifth owner Rick Weibel about this weekend's seventh annual Taste of Downtown. What does this event do for the downtown Lansing scene, Mindy?
It just brings people back to the urban core from throughout the region to really showcase the evolving market and different types of businesses and things that you can do in the downtown area. And really creates a fun atmosphere that encourages people to come back.
Have you seen it affect downtown over the years? This is the seventh time around.
We have. We get great feedback. We cap it. We don't allow over 1,500 people, so we keep it as a very high-quality event. And we want to make sure everyone has a good time. So we encourage people to get tickets in advance. You can go online at tastedowntown.org. You can save $5 or $20 in advance until Friday. And it's just a really fun something to do. Get out of the house. Have fun with your friends.
Rick Weibel, you were on our program here just a little over a year ago. What's new at American Fifth since we talked last?
Well, actually, I think when we were on last, we weren't even open yet. So we have been open just over a year. We've expanded our spirit selection from just vodka when we began to now whiskey. We have gin. We have some white rum. We're aging bourbon and rye and a few other things in barrel as well.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, it's fun, though.
Mindy, tell us a little bit more about the cuisine here. I mean, we ticked through some of the restaurants that are going to be represented, but talk to us a little bit more, go a little deeper with us here. What kind of cuisine are we talking about?
I think you have everything from sweet to savory and vegetarian. So there's a lot of options for everyone. There's also over 120 wines you can sample from around the world. So a lot of the wines pair nicely with the food selections that are offered and also the dessert selections as well.
Rick, from your perspective there on North Larch at American Fifth, how do you see downtown Lansing changing just in the last year or so?
I'd say we're on an upswing for sure with the developments for housing that have opened up down here. I've noticed that there's a lot more people walking around. So, you know, the whole idea of a walkable community is increasing. There's a few things going on that are somewhat ingenuity-based, I guess. I mean, us is an original idea with Lansing Brewing Company opening up as well. There's some great businesses down on Washington Square, too, with Whipped and Glaze and Confuse. They're doing some really interesting things.
Are you getting customers from the stadium condos there overlooking Cooley Law School Stadium? You must be. You're so close.
Yeah, we do. We have some regulars that, you know, just kind of live right around here, and they'll stop in after work or after dinner and have some cocktails.
Mindy, I understand Downtown Lansing, Inc. has also been hard at work on something new. This is for kids, Lansing Adventure Club. What is that about?
Yes, that kicks off Saturday as well and runs through August 19th. And it is a program for kids targeted at ages 5 through 12. To really get disconnected from their tablets and electronics and really doing fun things outside and being a kid and enjoying the summer, and then getting them downtown into different businesses and attractions to collect badges.
How does it work, though? What do they do?
They get an adventure guide. They can pick it up at the Downtown Lansing, Inc. office, and it is 21 days, 21 activities, and one great adventure. So the guide, it shows you all the participating businesses, what activity you need to do, and then you bring in right on the guide the proof that you did the activity to that corresponding adventure station, which is the business, and they get a badge. So they collect all of these on a lanyard, and then if they have 15 or more, they can enter to win a bunch of great prizes.
Mindy, I asked Rick Weibel how he feels Lansing, downtown Lansing, is changing here and now, summer of 2016. Let me ask you the same question. What do you see changing right now? What is changing here in this summer?
Well, we have two really distinct districts that are revolving in downtown. We have Washington Square and then the Stadium District area, so this side east of the river and west of the river. And in Rick's neighborhood, it's really developing into a neighborhood. There's tons of new residential development. It seems like we can't build residential quick enough. They fill up. You mentioned the outfield. It's completely leased. There's nothing available there.
How about that?
And they're getting ready to break ground this fall on Marketplace 2, right along the river, so that'll add another 85 units right in Rick's backyard. as well. So we're seeing that area devolve residentially, lots of recreational type activities with kayaking on the river, the Lansing Brew Runs with playmakers, and different great nightlife down there. And then Washington Square is really catering more towards transition and the huge workforce market. So you're seeing more quick convenience type things, and I think you're going to see more of that continue to evolve in the year ahead.
Well, getting people to live downtown has got to be a real spark. We want to thank our guests, Mindy Bilodeau, Executive Director of Downtown Lansing, Inc., and American Fifth owner Rick Weibel. We've been talking about this weekend's 7th Annual Taste of Downtown. Hope it goes well, guys. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll talk with a Michigan delegate or two to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Plus, we'll also talk with rock legend Peter Frampton ahead of his performance Thursday night at DTE Music Theater in Clarkston. That and more Wednesday here on Current State. Our executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Kevin Labry, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. We hope you have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow. It's Current State on WKAR.